Nervous Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nervous Netter, just talking to teachers.
Naylor's Natter the Book, ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them, and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, listener, for the very last episode of Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers. I thought I'd start this last episode with the introduction of Naylor's Natter, the book. So the introduction is a rationale for podcast pedagogy, and it talks a little bit about how the podcast came about and how I hope that the book will take the podcast forward and become an interactive CPD resource that teachers and schools can use. 3rd of January 2019, Naylor's Natter launches to rapturous reception from thousands of expectant teachers just waiting for a weekly dose of educational expertise dropping into their podcast provider of choice. Well, not quite. At the time of Naylor's Natter inception, I was a self-titled assistant director of Blackpool Research School, part of the Research Schools Network, a collaboration between the Institute for Effective Education and the Education Endowment Foundation. I'd seen the director title on future guest Alex Quigley's door at Huntingdon School and decided to adopt my own title. Future guests Stephen Tierney, Simon Cox and I were looking at ways to promote our upcoming Research Ed Blackpool conference. The prevailing wisdom amongst us at the time was to explore Stephen's book of Twitter contacts and persuade them to appear by offering them a night out in Blackpool. The approach had begun to work. We had a stellar list of speakers and a venue that could hold up to 600 guests. As the weeks rolled by, the tickets sold gradually, but we were struggling to get the required interest in the conference to justify our venue choice. We looked at paid marketing, promoted tweets, sponsored Facebook posts and all manner of networking, but nothing really captured the zeitgeist. At one of our regular meetings with Stephen, I tentatively floated the idea of a Blackpool Research School podcast. This was far from a new idea and one that I had clearly plagiarised from the guru of podcasting, namely Mr. Craig Barton. The idea met with a positive response from both Stephen and Simon, but with one sticking point. Probably best not call it the Blackpool Research School podcast. We don't want to damage the brand if it isn't very good. A very sage point at the time is the research movement was in its infancy and the research school had to ensure they were on message. As someone without a brand to tarnish, I happily volunteered to put my name to the podcast and take any brickbats that may come my way. Notice that it's Naylor's Natter, singular, meaning that I only ever expected there to be one episode. Looking back from the vantage point of a pandemic-scarred 2022, it's easy to forget that buried deep inside computers in 2019, we had all the technology required to easily record, edit and distribute a podcast. But I either didn't know or didn't look because the earliest episode features Simon Cox and me recorded live into an iPad and then emailed straight across, dropped into Anchor. As you'd expect, the episode sunk without much of a trace, despite Simon's excellent interview, and you can use the QR code on page 23 to have a listen. As it went largely unnoticed, this provided breathing space at least to begin to hone the craft of interviewing, source guests from Stephen's contacts and invest in some sound effects and a jingle. Ah, the jingle. You're singing it now, aren't you? I'd love to claim credit for its earworm status, and of course I do retain writing credits for the lyrics at least. This came about to a friend of the show, Benjamin D. Barker, who was already the established host, recommending a website called Fiverr, which allowed creators to advertise their craft to budding entrepreneurs. I figured to sound more professional, Naylor's Natter would need some voiceovers and jingles. I invested in numerous versions, some you can still hear in early episodes, but one really stood out. The jingle that has adorned most of our output since then was recorded by an established American country artist who, like me, was just dipping his toe into the new technology. This was without doubt the best £17 I've ever spent. He must be aware of the podcast's prominence these days, as I asked him for a new version recently, but let's just say that the price had increased exponentially. With the jingle in place, we then needed to up our game with guests, and a notable early coup was Professor Daniel Mers, who was at the time Ofsted's head of research. The excitement in the research school broom cupboard when he was confirmed was palpable. Whilst our marketing had progressed, our sound had not. For any reader expecting George Martin sitting behind a mixing desk while Simon and I stroked our beards, chewing the research fat with Ofsted's head honcho, think again. The episode was Simon and me with a hastily arranged Do Not Disturb sticky note on the research cupboard door, on the phone to Daniel with a voice recorder from an iPad trying to pick up the sound. We got away with that one, as a small room actually enhanced the audio. I was not so lucky when I lured one of education's titans, Professor Michael Young, onto the show. Michael was a delight to host and I remain a huge admirer of his work, but the audio was so bad it's almost unplayable. These episodes increased our listener base significantly, our ticket sales modestly, and our negative reviews judiciously. I'm a firm believer in the positive power of social media. The support received for this podcast has kept me going through its 18 months gestation. In the early days of the podcast, we had some great support. An early supporter and one whose influence can still be heard is Ollie Lovell. Ollie is an extremely successful and respected podcaster in his own right, and I would wholeheartedly recommend his ERRR podcast to all of our readers. In the early months of 2019, he got in touch with me to ask what software I used for recording the podcast. Somewhat taken aback, I replied that I used a phone, an iPad, and Anchor. He was so generous in his advice around selecting a microphone, using GarageBand and Audacity, and how to improve our production. This advice made a huge difference, and his generosity is something I've tried to emulate with new podcasters to welcome them into our thriving community. We started to settle on a formula which has seen some iterations, but the core concepts have remained essentially the same. I personally enjoy many different kinds of interview, whether it's education, politics, history, sport. Where I do take issue and usually turn over is when an interview becomes more about the interviewer than the interviewee. When I was discussing my interviewing style in the early days, I rather impertinently compared myself, in style, not quality, to the great Michael Parkinson. I would like to ask prepared questions to allow guests to feel comfortable. I would read everything I reasonably could about their work to be informed, and I would never interrupt. Well, almost never. I would, of course, allow some natural follow-up, but never at the expense of the guest's contribution. I think at the time, and even now, this marks Nailers Natter out as different from other podcasts, and it's the reason we've expanded across the world. The formula became about continuing professional development, CPD, for me as a host, and then hopefully vicariously for the listener. If I was gaining professionally by having one-to-one access to these experts, then surely the listener will be benefiting from their wisdom as well. My vision became and remained that if one person benefits from the conversation, then it's worth doing. Often I'm reminded of the power of this when I return from work exhausted and caught up in the thick of thin things, and I have a podcast scheduled at 7 p.m, meaning I literally have 23 minutes to get ready. As I slump into my recording chair, I swim up enough energy to get started. But when the podcast starts and the knowledge of the guests and their enthusiasm for the subject infuse me with a new energy, I imagine listeners having the same feeling, and I hope they're bound into school the following day imbued with new ideas that they can share. This is our raison d'etre. The podcast succeeded in attracting guests with some notable education figures gracing early episodes. Once you've interviewed person X, it makes it much easier to interview person Y. And this culminated for me with the episode where I interviewed E.D. Hirsch. Having seen at first hand the influence of Don's work through involvement in the research and evidence movement, I literally had to pinch myself when he agreed through his PA to appear. My preparation, always thorough, hit new levels in anticipation of a conference with the great man. The day itself was everything I expected and more. I can still recall the Skype dialing tone fading as the camera switched on to Hirsch resplendent in a leather armchair in a palatial office in America. The titan of knowledge must have wondered what he had signed up to as he gazed upon a young Ken Bruce sat at a computer desk amongst Minnie Mouse teddies in Child 2's bedroom. These conversations hopefully serve to inform and inspire the reader that anyone can become involved in podcasting and further their own professional growth on the way. Collaboration has been a huge part of the show over the years. The first supporters of the podcast with time, resources, equipment and moral support were the Teacher Development Trust, TDT. I cannot express my gratitude enough to David Weston and the team, who, as well as buying me my first proper microphone, contributed influential sections to many of the first 100 episodes. TDT were able to connect us to many guests we interviewed. They were also able to have their collective finger on the educational pulse, often guiding the listener to the latest research, evidence, and CPD. TDT decided to go their own way in 2020, but they've remained supporters of the podcast. A public thank you is due to them all, and I wouldn't be in a position to write a book without them. As 2020 began and the pandemic hit, it allowed time for reflection. I felt that seeing the world as I did through the paradigm of secondary education and a senior leader of some 10 years standing wasn't the only vista that the listeners needed. I felt that it was important for our listeners to diversify both our topics and our presenters. Many teachers have helped co-host and indeed host Nailers Natter over the last 3 years, and each of them has brought a unique perspective. This is a feature that we intended to continue. Features have been, well, a feature of Nailers Natter since the beginning, and something that my restless energy has been channeled into with varying degrees of success. As lockdown hit in early 2020, I started a book and film review section. The thinking was that the short 3-week lockdown could give teachers opportunity to delve into areas that their previously busy lives have prohibited. I'd long been a fan of Kermode and Mayo's film review on BBC Radio 5 Live, an attempt to channel my inner critic to signpost listeners to classic films. The feedback was non-existent, and his feature slowly ebbed away and has never been reprised. Book reviews have had much more success and have now become a staple of the show. Thanks to the explosion in teacher authors and books about education, I decided to look into reviewing them. This was slightly at odds with my non-judgmental approach to the podcast, and therefore precluded some books that I was either not interested by or some that I intrinsically avoided. The Vinyl Suite. The Vinyl Suite is another feature that has proved to be very popular indeed, but hugely time-consuming. The concept came from the office that Andrew Perman, High Noon, and I shared at the school at the same time. Being two gentlemen of a certain age, confirmed audiophiles and music snobs, we decided that a record player was the perfect addition to our office. The thinking was to ease our path through the pastoral trials and tribulations of a Blackpool day and help to educate the young people and the teachers about the importance of music. These selections opened up discussions that were outside of the normal conversations in schools, which so often start, "Did you get my email?" The format is an education version of Desert Island Discs, where listeners get to see behind the curtain and into the lives of our guests. Some of the suggestions have made a huge contribution to the making of the book. The two best exponents of the art of the Vinyl Suite were Dave McPartland and Doug Lamov. Their episodes featuring stories behind their choices continue to attract large audiences months after their release. Dave shared his and Flake Fleet's journey to the Britain's Got Talent final and their bid for Christmas number one. His choice of Dire Straits' Local Hero and Queen's Don't Stop Me Now raised the hairs on the back of my neck and really emphasised the power of music to shape people's lives. Doug Lamov, unscripted, hit upon a golden formula for the Vinyl Suite when he shared what he was listening to as he wrote his epic Teach Like a Champion 3.0 in 2021. Doug challenged the listener to see if they could hear the music coming through the pages of the book, and with it opened up listeners' collections to music that they may not have ordinarily sought out. I have bought, shared and treasured many records as a result of this feature, and at the time of writing I am listening to William Basinski. Thank you, Simon Cox. Having begun to diversify the range of guests and presenters on the podcast, I have become open to voices all across the educational sector. This crossed the false dichotomies that exist within education and developed relationships with teachers who previously would not have been listeners or contributors to the show. Following our most successful podcast ever with Paul Dix, I applied to host a weekly show on Teacher Hug Radio, which would essentially be a version of the podcast. This community moved the podcast on immeasurably. Their kindness, expertise and advice, given graciously by the Teacher Hug team, improved our production, the diversity of thought and the content of the show. Ultimately, the editing and scheduling became too much alongside the regular everyday job of a busy, by now, deputy head. I also became conscious that we were drifting away from the core of what made the podcast useful to listeners. We had stopped just talking to teachers and had spent less time on research and evidence-based practice. We had also largely moved away from giving listeners practical tips from serving teachers so they could use in the classroom. We had tried to be all things to all people. At the time of writing, we have chosen to go back to the basics in terms of content, but excitingly have been chosen by Spotify to be an early adopter of their video podcast form. This means that rather than having to release a multi-format podcast on various providers, we can now offer listeners the chance to view guests as well as listen simultaneously. We feel this will increase our appeal as teachers can now demonstrate as well as articulate the points. The medium itself also lends itself to CPD sessions for staff provided for free. This means 2022 will be an exciting step on our continuing journey of talking to teachers. Having taken you through the genesis and evolution of the podcast, here is our rationale for the book and how it can benefit you. The best that has been thought and said, Matthew Arnold, 1869. Not for a minute am I comparing the output of an educational podcast to the classic of modern literature, but I've kept Arnold's words with me and they have provided the inspiration and guidance for this book. An education book written by a teacher of over 20 years standing may have some use. My perspectives on educational development may be of note. My wisdom, such as it is, gained from working closely with some outstanding practitioners over a long and varied career, may help prevent others from making similar mistakes to my own. The book, however, is not that. This book is the accumulation of hundreds of hours of conversations with over 150 guests on the key topics in education, from CPD, behaviour, school leadership and pastoral care, to the future of education.
Reading this book may serve to increase your knowledge in much less than the 3 years it has taken me to accumulate the information to compile the book. For each topic, I've distilled hours of relevant conversations into a set of clear, practical recommendations, translating the collective wisdom of the podcast's guests into actionable advice for teachers, school leaders, governors, and the wider profession. A key theme throughout is cutting the binary debates that happen on social media in order to unite tribes and escape echo chambers. I hope that by exploring the thoughts and opinions of a wide range of podcast guests, you will find that there is more to unite us as educators than to divide us. The advice draws upon my conversations with all the guests on the podcast to date at the time of writing in early 2022. However, for each topic, I've selected a range of key experts and key guests whose contributions and thinking I'm keen to explore in more detail. From Professor Michael Young to Professor Becky Allen to Dr. Jill Berry, Aziza Ajak, Pritesh Ruchura, and Paul Dix. My hope is that we will set you off on an educational journey to the works of these luminaries in the world of education. I hope the book will serve as reference text for study into the outputs of the featured educators, set up as it is with handy QR codes to directly reference their podcast episodes as you go along your journey.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the very special and last ever Naylor's Natter. So emotional, but hopefully very useful, very practical, and we are delighted to have the guest that we've got. We're not going to come to him just yet because I need to introduce our co-host today. So many of you have heard me talk over the years about the vinyl suite, and we had a section when I had a music license or when I paid it. So if you know anyone's listening, I haven't got one currently, but when I did and when I paid for it, the man who is the inspiration behind the vinyl suite, the man who's got the record player in the office still, Andrew Perman, is joining us today. So Hi New, it's supposed to be Hi New, Hi Noon on Twitter, is joining us today. So welcome, Mr. Perman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Naylor. And just as I said, you know, obviously Hi New should have been Hi Noon. And obviously people who don't realise why, we did have an affinity with Alan Partridge from the Oast House. And obviously Hi Noon was who trolled Alan Partridge. So now that people know who Hi New is, after this show, if anything goes out, Mr. Natter, I will delete Hi New and I'll put my real name on there. That will probably decrease my followers by at least, oh, I don't know, 5.
Fantastic. So like I said, delighted to have as our last ever guest a man who's been on the podcast almost as many times as I have. It's the Stricko Master. He's here. Sam Strickland is in the building. Welcome, Sam.
Good evening and or good morning or afternoon, depending on when you listen to this. But thank you so much for having me yet again. I expect to claim the Ballon d'Or of the Naylor Natter world.
Well, absolutely. And it's up for grabs now, Sam. So, I mean, you can take it on from here if you want. You know, you can do what you want with it. This is it. We're officially retiring. We're going into writing, if anyone will have me. But yeah, it's been great. And thank you for the episodes that you've done. So the reason that Andrew's joining us today is that obviously he is a current practicing deputy head who is leading on behaviour. And the new book that we're talking about is The Behaviour Manual, which is a superb, superb book that we've both been reading in the last couple of weeks. And Andrew's literally been reading today. So we're going to have some questions that we're going to get into. But first, congratulations on the book, Sam. It's had a really good reception. Like we said, we found it really useful. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you ever so much. That means a lot.
Okay, so let's get into the question. So the first one that I'm going to ask you is, obviously, you're a head teacher. So should the head teacher be the person that leads on behaviour, or should this be delegated?
Right, my own view, you know where I'm going to go with this. Yes, the head teacher should lead on behaviour. If you're going to transform a school culture, you're going to shift it, you're going to change it, you've got to own it. You've got to be the one that dictates kind of the rhythm, the heartbeat of how a school culture, a school behaviour system should look. If you don't know what it needs to look like, then how will anybody else? Everyone else might have a view or an opinion, but actually, ultimately, it's got to come back to you. And I think I've sort of debated this before with people. I'm yet to work for a head teacher where if they say no, something then subsequently happens. The head directs the culture of any school that they work in, whether that's good, bad, or indifferent. And I think it's no accident that the head teacher standards cite that the head is responsible for behaviour, culture, climate, ethos. Yes, you can delegate that out to somebody else to do it on your behalf. But I think ultimately, and that's certainly in the infancy, when you're establishing what you want, it's got to come from you. yes, you can get feedback and input from everybody else. But yeah, I guess in a nutshell, my answer is it should run through the heads. You can't dislocate yourself from it.
And how difficult is that? You know, I mean, obviously, you've had quite a journey with your school. I remember coming to see you speak at Research Ed Rugby, which has got to be 3 and a bit years ago. Yeah. And I just remember seeing you up with all your staff and the culture that you built there. You know, so how difficult is that when you came in as a new head teacher to say that you're going to be leading on behaviour? Was that quite a difficult thing to do initially?
I think where you've got to be brave here is a lot's down to the state of the school that you're kind of taking over. But if I think about my own experience, behaviour was the big thing. There were other things that were wrong with the school. But if we didn't fix behaviour first and get the culture to a positive culture where pupils can learn and teachers can teach, nothing else was ever going to happen. So the brave decision was that's the clear focus for the full first, you know, entire year in post. We're going to focus on nothing but the culture, the climate, the ethos, the working conditions, the learning conditions, behavior, the behavior systems, until they become habitual as much as they possibly can. And I appreciate you kind of within that, you're almost discarding other things that can help drive school improvement. Of course they can, but I think you've got to look really carefully about how much can staff members actually take on board and how much can they drive themselves. When you're teaching 22 out of 25 periods a week, and then you've got the, you know, the big boss saying, well, we need this, and this done, your brain's just going to go into overload. Or actually, in the case of many teachers, they'll either try and do everything but badly because they're conscientious, but there's too much to do, or they'll just shut down. And I liken staff to a brand new bottle of water that you buy, you know, from Boots or wherever. When you take the lid off, the bottle is filled pretty much close to the top. There's a tiny little gap. And the more you pour in, the more likely that bottle is to overflow and become a giant mess. And I see school improvement very much in that guise. You know, you pick your one big thing that you want to fix, to change, to have it look how you want it to look, and go for that. Then go for your next thing. But for me, if behaviour isn't right, I could have talked to my staff about curriculum, pedagogy, the latest, you know, theory around cognitive science, whatever it might be, and it wouldn't have landed because it would have been like whistling in the wind. They would have all just said to me, the kids don't behave. I could prepare the most grandiose lesson, Sam, for you, or for the pupils rather, but they don't behave. It's not going to land with them. What's the point? And they would have been absolutely right. So I didn't want to waste staff's time. I guess the other aspect is if behaviour isn't right, it's your biggest win. If you get that right, staff are more likely to go with you when you then talk about more intricate things, in my opinion and in my experience.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I'm going to come to Andrew in a second because obviously he's doing this on a day-to-day basis. And we're all doing this because one of Andrew's key phrases is he's always saying that, you know, behaviour is everybody's business. And it is, you know, and I feel that. So somebody that was leading on it previously and now doing teaching and learning, I can't walk past, you know, because what you permit, you promote, etc. I'm coming out with all the phrases, listener, today. I've got them all. But it absolutely is true. But just before I go to Andrew on this one, you know, how important is it then, Sam, in terms of that visible leadership, that you're in school every day as much as you possibly can? You walk the corridors, you're in at the classrooms, you're seen on break duty, that sort of thing. Because that must be difficult. And it's one of the things, I'm sure Andrew's the same, has kind of put me off in a way of thinking about headship. Because I think I like being around the school. I don't want to be in a finance meeting for 4 hours. I don't want to be in, you know, numerous HR meetings. I want to be out and about and doing. So how difficult has that been to be in school and be present?
Yeah, it is a really difficult balance because the nature of my school, it's a single academy trust. So we're one school. So whilst I'm the principal, I'm also the CEO, the exec head, the finance officer, you know, all those things kind of rolled into one. We've got, as you rightly cited, governance rolled into there. We're a behaviour hub lead school, which I know is something that we've, you know, pushed it for ourselves to be. But that means we're really outward facing. And there are points I have to go out and about from school, which there's an inner tension. Anytime I'm sat, you know, in the car or on a train going somewhere, I'm thinking, oh, you know, what's going on back at school? Not because I doubt my staff, but it's my own kind of, I guess, OCD, actually, ultimately. I have got probably traits of, you can't work in this profession if you haven't got elements of OCD within you, but my own inner difficulty to kind of let go of bits and, you know, of everything probably. I think when you first start out, especially when you're trying to turn something around, it goes back to probably my previous answer, you've got to pick something that's big that you're going to go for, that's going to make the biggest difference, and work at it till you've got it right. And to make brave decisions. So routine line management meetings, when you're trying to be a presence and change the culture of the school, do you shift those to after school? Do you actually say, do you know what, for September, we're going to have no routine line management meetings with anybody because it's just swamp the corridors, and show that we are a visible presence until we've got kind of a duty rota of two or three of us in terms of senior leaders up and running, as our norm. But in that first month, it's a real giant push to make sure that everybody is doing everything you expect in the right way, in the right manner, at the right time. But also where you pick up where there are issues or people aren't confident enough to enact what you've trained them already in, to role model it to them in real time in front of the kids, not to undermine them, but to support them in terms of what, whatever it is you're trying to implement. But I do think it's a real tension, because I'm going to sound really biased now, as a head, but you are pulled in all kinds of different directions, because your day, as it can as a deputy, to be fair, your day can go from dealing with Johnny hasn't got a red pen as you walk down the corridor as a member of staff catches you, through to talking about a £10 million budget in the next breath with your finance officer, a finance lead, to a major safeguarding issue that someone wants advice on, to, I think back to the early days of my tenure, a fight, a member of staff being sworn at, asking for support, a whole plethora of different things. And then you're always thinking in the back of your head, you've probably got a billion emails coming in because it's the nature of the job, however much we try and restrict them. And you need to find a window of time to look at those, because ultimately you need some semblance of a work-life balance. I'm not sure really what that is in that those higher echelons of senior leadership. And invariably, you've probably got a meeting after school, whether it's SLT, middle leaders, or something that's trust-wide, if you're in a multi-academy trust, or governance-wide, as a single school. So there's a lot of conflicting pressures, and it's always trying to carve out the time to make sure that you've at least walked the school two or three times in the school day, so people do see you and they do know that you are going to be out and about at some point, and not having it at the same time every day. Otherwise, that becomes a little bit predictable.
No, it's a great point. I'm going to come to Andrew in a second, because he's the embodiment of this, like I said, at our school. You know, he's the person who's called on the radio. He's the person that you hear from reception. It's Mr. Perman, Mr. Perman. In fact, I get called Mr. Perman on a regular basis, because the kids see him much. Well, I'd like to think as much as me, but they certainly try to remember. Anyway, Sam, just as a joking aside, I've got a new thing on visible leadership, which is a Panama hat, which means that when I wear it out at lunchtime, it means that everybody's seen me. So everybody knows that Mr. Naylor is in the building today. And I've been roundly mocked and ridiculed for the choice of headwear, but it's working. Talk about visible leadership. Nobody can say, I don't know if Mr. Naylor's in school today, because he looks like the man from Del Monte out on the yard, but you can see him. He's there. Anyway, Mr. Perman, your views on visible leadership.
Thank you. First of all, Sam, with regard to the visible leadership and the Panama hat, do bear in mind Phil's already wearing a lovely gilet that is bright green. So it's not as if you can't see that, first of all, but yet he's gone that extra level, which Mr. Naylor does do, and gone for the Panama hat. Brilliant. Just support what you said, Sam, about the leadership. I agree. Someone has to lead and be the implementer. Someone has to do that. But I think what's going to be the challenge, as Phil said, when I took over from Phil at Easter in this role, when I did my presentation, I talked about whole school ownership. So since I've been at South Shore, I've worked with Phil on the behaviour, but I have led on attendance. And what we've managed to do is get whole school ownership, so everyone owns attendance. And that's been reflected. We've had good data. We've had visits from Ofsted this year, the Trust, DfE advisors, and they've all seen the proactive and whole school ownership. And that's what I said when we went for the interview at Easter, is that what we have to reflect on. And shamelessly, I'm plugging you again, but in my interview, I mentioned you and Tom Bennett. Unfortunately, I didn't mention Mr. Natter, but I did mention you and Tom about that whole ownership. Mm-hmm. And for it to work, as you said, and you repeat it through your books along with Tom, for it to work, it has to be the whole ownership. And like the visible, you said, Sam, Phil said one word, I remember back at Easter time. And yeah, you've got to be visible, but you've got to demonstrate what you want to promote. I mean, I know you've got it in your book, what you promote, you permit. And I know Phil said it, and I say it to the kids as well. But, you might come on to it in a minute, Phil, about the rules. We've got our South Shore 7, and one of them is left is best. So if I walk along the corridor and you see a member of staff on the opposite, you know, you've got to say, even to the member of staff, you've got to demonstrate those rules. And as you said, Sam, in the book about be habitual, you know, consistent again and again and again. And eventually the kids will understand why you do it, and they'll do it because they know it's for the right reason.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Byrne. Right, into the next question. So what I like about this book, Sam, is that it's a book that you can read right through. So it's a book that you can pick up and you can read right through. And like Andrew said, he's done that this afternoon. But you can also dip in and out of it. So at whatever stage of your career you're at, or whatever stage in terms of your leadership journey, you can dip in and say, right, I want some information on, for example, school rules or lineups. Or, I mean, some of the stuff in the classroom was great. So we're going to come to that. So if we kind of touch on a few of those separate sections now, moving through. So the first one, it's a big one. School rules, yes or no?
Yes. It's like saying you'd have, and I know other people have probably said something quite similar, that you have no rules for the road, you know, no speed limits, no speed cameras, etc. You don't know where you stand. You've got to have school rules. Children need boundaries. They need consistency. They need to understand what is and isn't permissible. And I think if you haven't got school rules, and I know of schools that don't, I think you're setting yourself up for a fall, because then you're ultimately, you're not being objective when you then do deal with a pupil. And you say to a child, you know, that behaviour was inappropriate, and you know, I'm going to call your parents, or whatever, you know, the sanction, or I'm going to put you in detention, whatever the sanction may be. Where's that actually born out of? You don't like my behaviour, but why? Because it's not actually a rule within the school. It's just something that, I mean, you could be really challenged here. You're making it up, as opposed to it being a discernible, this is how we do things in this school. But I think the rules are just as important for the staff as they are for the kids, because they provide a degree of consistency and, dare I say it, conformity for teachers as well as the, as much as they do for the pupils. And then you throw in the other key stakeholder, families, parents, whoever's at home. You know, if you want their support, and you might not always get it, of course, you know, I'm not deluded here, but if you can say it, they've broken a rule, this is a real clear expectation of our school. That's harder to argue. Some parents will, of course. But if you have no rules at all, a parent might just say to you, do one. You know, get lost in the nicest of senses. Where's that come from? You know, my child can do what they like, thank you very much. So, yeah, I think if you want a school that's orderly and has got a sense of purpose, it's not just having rules, it's rules that are lived and breathed as well, that are consistently applied and with certainty. But certainly as a starting point, you have to have a clear, discernible set of rules. And I don't think you should have loads, because I think there's a danger that we could end up with a, you know, 5,000 bullet point list of rules, which again could be counterintuitive and counterproductive, because you can actually end up just not remembering what they are. I think they've got to be accessible, memorable, and digestible when you formulate your rules. And will everybody understand what they mean?
I think just what you say there, Sam, about the rules, obviously Phil, when he came, we spoke about what can we, as you said, the consistency, for the kids need rules. And no disrespect, I mean, I actually love working at our school. It's a fantastic school, the staff, the student. But obviously when you look at the context of our school, you know, Blackpool opportunity area, you know, when they go home in the summer term in 4 weeks' time, they got that 6 week break. And that, you know, they're not going to get that consistency that we, you know, demonstrate at our school. Mm-hmm. But Phil worked and introduced what we call the South Shore Seven. So it starts from seven expectations, seven rules, that starts from collecting the kids to ending the lesson. Mm-hmm. So in between the collecting of the kids and ending the lesson, what are the other five rules that they have to adhere to? So obviously left is best, you know, dress to impress. So you dress, end and send at the end, meet and greet. But it's dead simple. We've got in our school, Sam, every staircase has now got those South Shore Seven. So as you walk up the stairs, not only are they on boards around the walls and in every classroom, they're on our staircase. And, you know, when we say the left is best, Phil, we've got the little arrows that tell you. And, yeah, you do get some kids, but there was nothing better than a couple of weeks ago. It's Miss Smith, who teaches English. She wasn't with the class. I stood there and watched the whole class walk on their own down the left. So eventually, you know, as you said, Sam, you make it habitual and they will get it. They will. And that's what kids need. You know, when they leave us at 16, college, university, work, whatever, you know, they're the skills as well as the academic, you know yourself, Sam, that's what they need to survive in that big, bad world.
They absolutely do. And yeah, I think you get the argument, don't you, sometimes about SEN children and children with, you know, trauma, etc. I'm not refuting that those children, you know, don't exist. They do exist. But actually, those children need certainty and rules probably more than anybody else. And providing an orderly, calm, structured environment for children to thrive in actually allows those children to really thrive, which I think is a false argument that's kind of labored against schools that are very well structured, that you are anti-SCN, and that's not the case.
Sorry, Mr. Perman, go on.
I was just going to say, Phil, when we had the visit from Tom Bennett, he said exactly the same, Sam. He said everyone should be treated, you know, everyone needs the rules, everyone needs consistency. And as you said, Sam, before you went on to the staff do as well.
Absolutely.
You know, the staff need them as well. And it comes back to Phil gave the four Ds, and one that resonates with me is to demonstrate. And the staff needs to demonstrate that as well. So it's for everyone, Sam.
Of course it is. No, absolutely. I don't disagree.
And for copyright purposes, the Ds are from Running the Room by Tom Bennett. Thank you.
It's Dress for Success from Roxette.
Yes. Yes, we've got one Sparks today, but we can dig out some Roxette for you. I'm sure we can.
Nailers, Natter, just talking to teachers.
Sorry to kind of interject there. And those routines, habitual school-based routines, are just as important for the ECTs in your school, my school, every school. Because again, you think about cognitive load, the cognitive load that faces a brand new teacher to our profession, especially someone in those first 2 to 3 years of being in the profession, is enormous. We're expecting them to juggle so many different plates, you know, going beyond the realms of just the, you know, your curriculum, your subject knowledge, questioning, but also all the behavioural stuff as well. So the more of that we can take away for them to have to worry about, the more they can focus their energy and effort on the key thing, which is actually teaching as opposed to behaviour management.
Completely. Right, something else that we've taken from you over the years, Sam, is these are one of these kind of COVID hangovers, but useful COVID hangovers. So we've gone for lineups in the morning. So something that we've struggled with historically has been, punctuality to school, and actually having the so systematized and routinized, if that's even a word, way of lining up at the beginning of the day has really set some good habits. And, you know, I had a chat with Tom Bennett a couple of years ago in the summer term, and I came up with loads of just snappy ways of remembering things that people have been doing for years and years, but calling them slightly different things. So one of them was collect and inspect. So it was like, right, we do a lineup, you know, we blow a whistle at 25 past, everybody's to be on the lines, staff, students ready. We blow it at 8:30, and then it's the routine and everyone starts. But we did a lot of the checks that would have taken away from learning time, that would have taken away from anything else that we're doing, PSHE, register and read, things that we do in that time, and just organize, right, you know, have you got the correct uniform on? Are you ready to learn? But also, and again, I said this to Paul Dix last year, you know, it's not like a military academy. You know, we say, good morning, how are you? Nice to see you. You know, have a great day. It can be positive as well. But what I'm coming round to is you've done a section in Behaviour Manual about lineup. So, you know, how important have they been for you, and would you recommend them to other people?
They've been massive for us as a school. We brought them in about 3.5 years ago. And I wanted to get to a point where, you know, I was confident enough they were going to work before you ever launch anything. And we do them at the start of our school day as well. They've absolutely helped with punctuality. Pupils know they've got to be on time. There's no kind of hiding place. If you've got, you know, all of your peers from your year group outside lined up in front of their tutors. And the way that ours work is that pupils come in through different entry points in the school within the context of their year group. And they're already lined up outside the school building and then invited to come in. They then line up in front of their tutor and they're stood in front of their tutor in a single file line. The director of year, head of year in old money, is there. I'm there. I blow a whistle. I ask them to fall silent. They fall silent. And it's no different, to be quite frank, than an indoor assembly. It's outdoors, stood up. And it's an opportunity on every single day, unless it's raining, that's the only time we ever suspend them, to engage in a daily institutional form of messaging to our pupils and to our staff. It is training. And it's an opportunity that we can cover values, virtues, character virtues, things that are coming up in real time. There's a parents' evening next week. You know, it's a Mufti day next week. Key messages. If we're not happy with behaviour, we can address that. If there's something major happening in terms of a school trip or a careers event, we can reference that. And just because of the physicality of our building, our assembly hall only allows us to hold one year group at any one point in time. So we can't have five back-to-back indoor assemblies in the morning. It just would, otherwise, we'd forever be in assembly with the pupils. So this just allows us to do assemblies daily outdoors. And equally, as you rightly reference, you know, the checking of uniform and checking of equipment, the tutors will do that while the pupils are in the lines, while I'm addressing them. But in the early days of kind of bringing that about, I had senior leaders role modeling it to staff. This is what we expect. And again, it's training for the tutors. And the other side is when you start your day with just tutor time, you don't do lineups, but you say to tutors, we want you to check X, Y, Z. You're actually leaving it to chance as to whether that will happen or whether it will not. Your good staff will do it. Your staff that are perhaps less confident or don't believe in it won't ultimately do it in the way that you want or just won't do it at all. So this actually brings them out a greater degree of consistency. And then when people can actually see the benefit of that, they're more likely to apply it consistently themselves, you know, at other points in the school day. Because actually, yes, it's really important that you've got your pencil case. Why? Because you've got all your equipment. You can get on with your learning. It's one less barrier. It's one less argument. It's important to be dressed smartly because actually that's part of our overall psyche for the day. And we always finish on like a He-Man style, you know, message of the day. And I hand over to the director of year, who then gives a year group message from his or her own perspective as well. It's also a great opportunity to platform success, which we do a lot of, whereby we know that last night the year 10 football team won something, or so-and-so's gone off and done their Duke of Edinburgh gold. You know, let's get them stood up on the bench next to me and everyone give them a round of applause. So it's about platforming kids as well. We find them really, really powerful.
What you said, there's a lot of things that you said there, Sam, but a lot of it resonates. I mean, I don't know whether you have actually mentioned this in your book, but you said again, when they arrive to school, before they actually do the lineups, you said something about they come in their own separate entrance. Mm. I was actually discussing that last night with a colleague about when they come to school, seven's this entrance. You're met by we have pastoral leads head of year. So you met and your uniform's checked. You're welcomed. It's the meet and greet, one of our South Shore seven. Mm. So we're actually going to do that for September. So each year group goes in a different gate. They'll all end up on the yard together. But as you said, the inspection, and it cross-references with the role of the form tutor. So yep. They get to meet them straight away. And as you said, they go in a calm manner. You know, before COVID, we never had lineups. So they'll come into the yard. They might mingle around. Then through one door, in you go. You've got 780 kids piling in. But now they've lined up. They've met the form tutor. Mm. They've had messages, you said, from the head of year pastoral lead. You know, I like the platform, a success, you can do that as well. But you check the uniform and then you walk one in at a time, orderly manner.
Absolutely.
Going in, and it's that transition from outside to inside. And it just sets the day off on the right tone, Sam.
It really, really does. It's a brilliant opportunity to recalibrate your school every single day. Mm. The other added advantage of bringing in different year groups through different entrances, and I think there are multiple benefits here. You've got the meet and greet, as you rightly stated, and we've got that warm, strict kind of, you know, welcoming in the morning of good morning. And the strict bit is, you know, make sure your uniform's sorted. But equally, last night we know there was a major safeguarding issue with a pupil and we need to discreetly take that pupil aside. We can do that as they come in through that first entrance without anybody else seeing them. You know, we need to have a chat with you. There was a big problem for you last night. You know, do you need some help? Do you need some support? Flip side, I'm going to sound draconian now. You absconded from your after-school detention last night. And our rule in our school is we will isolate you the next day. We can get to you straight away without having to yomp around the school after you. So it speeds up the efficiency of all of our systems, whether they're supportive or whether they're sanction-based in dealing with or supporting pupils as well, which I think is massive.
Yeah, and I like what you said then about if you're waiting for your year group, these are your kids, okay? We're going to, we've got five year groups, obviously. We're going next September to five. So there's five heads a year, five pastoral leads. We've got three and they've got two sharing year groups. But now for next year, they can take the ownership of their year groups. You said, I use it a lot, live in the real world. Kids will have gone from a whole school detention. They will. And they will, you know, that's their kids because they're kids. So therefore, whereas at the moment, you've got 780 kids coming through one gate, mm-hmm. and you're trying to look for where's now their own individual gate, you've got 170 kids walking through, you'll pick them off straight away. And before they've entered the building, the problem's resolved. You know, 99.9, it will be resolved. They'll still get the 0.01 who will still say, well, no, I'm not going to. But it just makes it so much simpler, as you said, Sam.
And the other side is you get to speak to every single kid as they come in and say good morning. And I think that's just really important. It shows you're a human being. It shows you're not this sort of ogre. Yes, you need to have a firm edge to you as a senior leader or a head teacher. But ultimately, the kids know you're human. You're there for them. And I think that's part of it as well. That's the warm aspect.
Yeah. And just finally, Phil, I mean, when I think it was Rita, I forget her surname, we did the TED Talks about the education, but one word I always took from her as the formed you is that connection. And obviously, as you said, Sam, you're welcoming your year group, not every, no disrespect to the rest of the year groups, but these are your kids, your year group. You made that connection and you're going to be there for 5 years. Obviously, you will go home at night time, but you're going to be there for 5 years welcoming those kids. And it's that connection that you can develop as they first come into the gate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and just on that, in terms of if people haven't done that and go and look in Sam's book about the way that that can be done, but we found that it's exactly what you said, Sam, about the community aspect of it. You know, when I was at school in the 80s, you know, everybody came into the hall and we had an assembly every day. Nobody seemed to think that that was in any way draconian or, you know, some exhibiting some form of control. It was just part of the school community. Now, we can't do that because school sizes. So the way to do that is, you know, a morning address from the principal or whatever it might be.
Absolutely. And the other thing that they're really, I think they're great for is early training for exams. I know not everything should be about exams, but you think about how kids need to go into an exam. We deliberately have lineups before they go into exams, so they're walked in a calm, orderly fashion. So the pupils themselves are calm, they're in the zone, they're serene, they're ready to go, rather than a chaotic rabble of kids bombing down a corridor, knocking into each other as they go into an exam hall. So it's about training for that as well.
Yeah, completely. And Andrew's in charge of the, I don't know what he's going to say in a minute, the fire drill as well. Yeah. So, I mean, you can imagine what the fire drill used to look like 3, 4, 5 years ago. And it was like, right, we've heard a bell and we're all making to the nearest exit and we don't know where to line up and where's the clipboard. Now, the fire drill is about he's got it timed, he has it on his clipboard, but it's about a 2-minute job. You know, if we've got a fire drill, the door's gone, whatever it is. I mean, we get outside, we line up and it's absolutely fine because everybody knows what to do.
I mean, when we did it, when I've been at South Shore South for 4 years, finishing now, year one, as you said, when you get to a certain level, you get every job, don't you? But you love it. So I am a fire marshal. I could put that on my CV, fire marshal. But obviously, as you said, I love it. I love the data. I love the competitive elements. I used to come out. So in my first year, I mean, I don't mind saying there were like 17 minutes. So from the bell going, coming out of school, lining up, registered to take it, 17. I thought, this isn't. So at the moment, as Phil said, not that we do it on it for a competitive reason, but the last time we did it, you said about the rules. So one of our 7 is hands up, hush up. So the staff puts their hands up, the kids know what to do, they're quiet straight away. And we've got it down to just under 8 minutes. So, you know, that's from the bell going. So, they're not running out. They've got to orderly come out in an orderly manner. But it just shows, as Phil said and you said, Sam, you put that clear guidelines, those rules in place. The kids understand why they're doing it and they'll work with you all the time.
It's the narration of why. As long as you can explain why you're doing it and the benefit of it. You know, we're doing X because this is why we are doing it. Kids tend to understand.
I mean, it's like Phil's alluded to the punctuality. I know we digress, but I do that a lot. But, I mean, I've got X number of girls who come in like 40 minutes late and they think, well, all I've done is miss form time. I'm here to get my learning. But I also say, I know I'm old, ancient and decrepit, but this is what we're trying to get you in school, not just the academic, but it's the life skills that. And in 5 years' time, when you leave, you wake up and go to work and your boss says, oh, you're 40 minutes late. Oh, just go in and do you. The boss isn't, you and I, us three know that. And that's why as adults, we're trying to impart that knowledge onto the students. So, you know, and if you keep doing it, as you said, Sam, and you put what you permit, you promote. And if you permit that, the lateness, again, and again, kids say, well, that's fine to do. But it's getting them to understand why we are doing this. And Phil alludes to it a lot. He'll say, look, you know, if I'm letting you down, you know, that's not what I'm here to do.
Yeah, if I let you off, I'll let you down. We're getting all Sam's greatest hits out here, aren't we? This is great for the listener. We're enjoying it. And also, the bad thing about doing this with Andrew, Sam, is that now everything that I, when I sound really wise and like I know what I'm talking about around the SLT table, because people around our table are maybe not as Twitter savvy as perhaps I am. Now, my whole cover has been completely blown, hasn't it? Any of these ideas that were supposed to be mine, they've all gone.
I didn't know that. Let You Down one was Sam's as well.
Oh, yeah, they're all Sam's. None of these are mine. None of these are mine. The only thing I can claim credit for is the South Shore 7, which was just, you know, that's the only thing I can claim credit for. And that's the jingle. But we'll come back to that.
The jingle.
Right, let's flip it into the classroom, because this is something again. So again, for the listener, I am banging a bit recently. So Sam, I've gone back into the classroom and I don't half talk about it a lot. You know, because I've
very rarely, Sam. It's a bit like a book, Mr. I never mention that, do I?
No, we never talk about my teaching. So I've gone back into the classroom, principally because obviously if you're leading on teaching and learning, again, the same as you talk about in your book, if you're going to be the lead person on behavior, the head teacher starts that. So if we're going to do teaching and learning, I should be in the classroom. Mm. But the reason I mention it now in your context is I like the work you've done around warnings. And I was discussing this with an early career teacher recently that, you know, we've got two warnings and then a buddy up. And you think, well, if you're allowing three free hits for every student, every single lesson. I mean, granted, most of them don't take those three hits, but you're allowing that. So you've talked about it in the book. So how many warnings should be given, and how important is de-escalation in trying to remove that the need for warning?
My view is that it should be one warning, and then you're into a sanction, and that's the system that we have as a school. I can't even speak properly now. What we have, if I can get rid of that weird stuff that's come from nowhere, is very clear classroom code of conduct on display in every single classroom. And teachers don't issue sanctions, they issue behaviour points. So if I fall foul of the classroom code of conduct, I get a behaviour point because I've disrespected the teacher, I've arrived ill-equipped, I've not done the work in the manner I should have done, I've been messing around, whatever it might be. And my first behaviour point is the warning. It's like a yellow card in football, basically. And, you know, the next time, you're off. In the case of our system, your second behaviour point results in a same-day centralised detention. And the amount of time that you're in detention for increases as you get more and more behaviour points throughout the course of the day. And for the vast majority of our pupils, you know, there may be exceptions to the rule, with kids that have got extreme levels of SCN and unmet needs and trauma, etc. But for, you know, 99% of our pupils, behaviour becomes a choice. Are you now, you've got behaviour point number one, going to misbehave again, knowing you're going to get a detention? Or are you going to kind of buckle up and do the right things? Because you know what our rules are, you know what our expectations are, because they're really, really clear. We talk to you about them all of the time. But what we find by giving out behaviour points is it depersonalises it as well. Because the teachers then are just talking about the specific behaviour. They're not giving a sanction. They're not saying, you're in detention for me. You know, rah. And then the pupil goes rah, back, and then it ends up turning into an argument. It's just a straight behaviour point. And if you're, you know, if you still stand there as a pupil and go, oh, I've now got detention, well, it's only your fault because you've already had a warning today and you shouldn't have misbehaved. So my view, it's one warning and then it's to a sanction. I think the danger with where you get kind of the three hits and then something happens, and I know we're kind of exemplifying a situation here that may not happen, but there's the potential that you've got the class from hell, all 30 kids think, I'm going to take you on today, stuff it, you know, because sometimes that can happen and all 30 go for you. You could be issuing 90 warnings before any kind of sanction is actually issued. And if that was happening every single day, just how exhausting is that for a teacher? You'd be spending more time warning, writing a pupil's name on the board, moving them seat before anything ever happens in terms of a sanction, and indeed before you can even get on with the learning with the class. And that's where those kinds of systems, and I don't really believe in low-level disruption as a term as such. I think disruption is disruption. That's where that low-level disruption comes in, because nothing really is ever going to happen.
Sorry, Sam. I mean, I'm being quite personal, but just asking about a question to do with South Shore Academy. So we're reflecting and looking at a lot of processes for next year. So you've got Phil comes into your lesson. You've given him that first warning, perhaps for being late to lesson. Right, Phil, you know you're late. The bell's gone. Okay, Phil, get on with work. 10 minutes later, Phil says he does something again that's against your behaviour expectations. Yep. He now has got a whole school detention. At that point, he still keeps Phil in your classroom, though. Is there any point where you think, right, Phil's gone too far, I need to buddy him up to another classroom?
Yeah, we have an alert button on Sims that staff can use to get pupils removed. And they're either removed for the lesson or the day, depending on what they've done. But when they're removed, and placed in either a pastoral leader's office or a senior leader's office. We don't have a isolation or withdrawal room as such. Our view is that it's actually more of a punishment to sit with me for the day than it would be in a room with maybe 15 other pupils, where there is the possibility they could all hijack that room and take over, or they could all learn pretty bad behaviours off one another. I think it's more a case of isolation is isolation. You are on your own with a leader and you have to engage with the work that's set for you for the day. So kind of in answer to your question, yeah, there has to be a point where enough is enough. You know, Phil is constantly disrupting my lesson and he's already accrued a detention and I've given him a second, in our system, a second behaviour point in the lesson. It's an even longer detention now and he's still not getting the message and my lesson is being completely disrupted by him. Then I think there's got to be a point where you go, he has to leave this room. Because, you know, of the learning needs of the other 29 pupils in that room, you know, in terms of just educational fairness, it's unfair on the other 29 pupils that their lesson is being destroyed because Phil can't stop misbehaving.
Yeah, totally agree. And I do like, I think, for the idea, as you said, if they do have to be taken out of that classroom, go to, because we spoke, Phil, about, we're going to call it restorative practice. But obviously, that's a shameless plug from Tom Bennett again. But obviously, you said if you take them out and you go to your pastoral leader, your head of year, your director of, I think you said director of a year, then obviously rather than sit in a room where, as you said, the mates might be there, you know, think, oh, great, this is a fun time, this. Mm. And whereas if they go to the pastoral leader and they try and resolve that issue, and again, you know, if the teacher gets involved, it's the whole ownership that we spoke to at the beginning. I do like that idea, and that's something that, you know, taking from what Sam said tonight, Phil, moving on for next year, you know, selfishly for South Shore, I think that's something we will certainly look at, Sam.
Well, and also, yeah, quite rightly, by isolating a pupil, either for the lesson or the day, with a senior member of staff, there is then that space to have that conversation behind closed doors about the behaviour that they've got wrong. To talk to the pupil in question about why it's gone wrong, rather than trying to hunt them down or find them in an open place like an isolation room and whip them out the isolation room and all the rest of it. They're already there, they're with you. And then you set the record straight with them. But now you're with me for the day. You are isolated, you know, if it's for the day that you're going to keep them. And now here's the work that you need to be doing for today. And my expectation is you're going to get on with that work.
And as you said, Sam, you know, kids are so complex. You know, Phil might be brought out for a second warning, but we don't know that Phil last night was up until 2 a.m.
Yep.
He's got arrested by the police, taken home. He was MFH. We don't know that. So by going to the pastoral leader, in a way, you've got a great chance straight away resolving the problem, getting Phil back on track. Whereas if you put him in sort of some inclusion room, you're there for the day, Phil, that those thoughts are still going to muster, you know, and by the end of the day, nothing's resolved, is it? So, no, I like that idea moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great stuff. So, I mean, we've kind of talked about detentions, but just in terms of the book and bringing it back to the book, you've talked about how you use centralised detentions. And obviously, you know, you're an all through school, aren't you? Mm. So how does that work in practice? And what are the advantages and disadvantages of a centralised system versus a phase-based or, a departments-based system?
Yeah, so in terms of how our centralised approach works, pupils who, you know, have accrued two behaviour points or more, which I just sort of referenced a minute ago, we have behaviour support officers behind the scenes who monitor, you know, all the data trackers that we have for the data, for the behaviour points that are being logged on Sims. They circulate a spreadsheet in the afternoon that goes out to subject teachers and to pastoral leaders, and then those pupils are collected from the rooms that they're in across the school and taken to year group centralised detentions after school. whereby they are welcomed by the pastoral duo that oversee the year group and by a senior leader as well. And if you end up in a senior leadership team detention, you go to a room which is manned by just senior leaders and just senior leaders alone for a much longer period of time. But in terms of the primary phase, the centralised approach is that those detentions happen at break and lunchtime, again with either phase leaders or the senior leaders that operate within the primary phase of the school. The benefits of this, to my mind, and I appreciate there'll be people saying who will probably try and cite here, but this de-skills teachers and teachers should run their own detentions. It takes away a burden from teachers, in my opinion. It frees teachers up after school to either go home at a sensible time, to, if they're a form tutor, maybe to make some really important calls home to parents that need to be made about tutees in their tutor group, or it allows them to think about their curriculum and to engage in, you know, all the things they should be doing in terms of co-planning and thinking about questioning. It buys them time to get on with, you know, marking, depending on what your marking policy is as a school. It allows them to do all the things that are based around the curriculum and teaching and learning and subject knowledge, to my mind. Decentralized systems, and I've worked in schools which have got decentralized systems. The danger here is that you can end up chasing your tail and you need to start to collaborate far more with other colleagues. Johnny has been a pain in the backside and you got a detention in history, maths, science, PE. He's had a shocker of a day. Everyone wants to put him in detention. Where does he go first? Johnny gets four detentions in a row throughout the course of the day. Thinks to himself, stuff it, I'm not going to know any of them because there's just so many. At what point do you stop chasing your tail? At what point are you going to discuss with other departments who has Johnny first in those kinds of situations? And I think there's also the opportunity cost side here as well. What would you rather your staff were doing, your teaching staff, manning a detention hall from a departmental or a subject-based perspective, or getting on with the thing that has the greatest impact in terms of school improvement when you take away behaviour, what happens in the classroom? And to my mind, it's an inordinate waste of money, if I put it into a monetary sense, to have all of my subject teachers and the heads of subject chasing something that could be taken away from them for their good, their benefit, and buy them time.
I think spot on, Sam, because as I mentioned before, we're going to five pastoral leads, and that's down to Miss Waters, our head teacher, getting that through. But that will be an amazing transformation because I want to do what you just said to. We have late detentions at lunchtime and whole school at the end. But I like what I want the pastoral leader, the head of years, you said at the gate in the morning, they're taking that ownership. So when we have the lates at lunch and the whole school at the end of the day, the pastoral leader with the head of year support will go around and collect. So year seven, you've got three kids today. Yep. They go and collect those three kids and they base it wherever, rather than all piling into one room again. It's year 7, 8, 9, 10. Yep. And again, it's just getting that connection again. So I know negative is probably the word. We have to like speak to them about their behavior, but yeah, you're with the team who will see you every single day. And that surely, you know, if they're going to correct their behavior and, you know, accept the rules and the expectations we want them to achieve, then they're going to do it with the people they make that connection with. So 100% agree with what you say, Sam.
And you can pick up on patterns and trends. You know, Sam keeps getting detained every day. What's going on with Sam? And then when you have that conversation with Sam, it turns out that there's been a bereavement. There's a major safeguarding issue we didn't know about. And she divulges that. It might be that every Thursday, period five, it's not going right. Why is that? Why are you not engaging in that particular lesson? I'm not blaming the teacher here, but what's going on? It allows you to think a little bit more forensically about things. What the patterns of detentions in general, is there a theme that's underpinning them? And is there something you need to respond to as a school? So it allows you to think about things, I think, far more sharply than if you just, the phrase I use a lot is leaving things to chance. And when you push it out to everybody else to deal with, you are leaving things to chance.
No, 100%. And if you're in a room that you've got 50 kids, you're running that detention, there's not going to be no resourceful practice going on. You're just going to make sure that they sit there. One or two might walk or fail, but at least going to the personalised year group detention, five-year groups, different places, you get that resolved. And we said, you know, Sam's had five lessons. What is going on, Sam? And you have that opportunity then to work with the people who know him best or her best and resolve the issue. So 100% agree, Sam. Thank you, Phil.
Right, just to remember for the listener, so we're talking to Sam Strickland about the Behaviour Manual, which is an educator's guidebook, and it's a John Catt book, and it's available everywhere now, and it's got some fantastic reviews, Sam, as well. And I know how hard that is to get all of those five-star reviews, because there's always somebody that puts one star on for whatever reason, but there isn't anybody at the moment, is there?
Never say never.
No, well, it's going down very, very well, and I'm not surprised at all, because like I said, I've really, really enjoyed it, found it really practical, really useful.
Thank you.
And the next question is going to be something that I took from this. So I think you've given the best articulation explanation of not having mobile phones in school. So you're talking to two people who've held the DSL role this year, and every debate around mobile phones seems to resolve, around, well, students might need them because they have to contact home, students might need them because parents need to know where they are, et cetera, et cetera. But you've talked about the reason that, mobile phones aren't being used, relating that to keeping children safe in education 21 and obviously the new iteration for 22. So just tell the listener a little bit about why it's been important for students' safety that you restrict the use of mobile phones on site.
Yeah, I think people who do challenge this about mobile phones and mobile phone use really need to walk in the shoes of a DSL for a week and just see the full bandwidth of what a DSL has to deal with. And I appreciate some schools say, we have no mobiles, but we allow them at break and lunch. And I think that's just, you may as well just say you allow mobiles, to be quite frank and quite honest with you. There's so many different factors here. Kids are on their phones relentlessly at the best of times. The minute they walk out the school grounds, they're probably on their phone. We're creating kind of a safe space for 6 or 7 hours where they're not engaging in screen time by banning phones in school. And I think that's really important, actually, because that high-speed dependency on your phone and the high-speed nature of how social media works, how YouTube works, everything's instantaneous. And actually, that doesn't lend itself really well to learning, ultimately, because then you expect a diet in your lessons of high-speed, high-octane, every 5 seconds something's going to happen. And learning isn't like that. Learning is really hard. So there's that side. You've also got just the outright safeguarding element. There's a pupil who's got their phone under the table or on the table because they're allowed to have them, and they're on Facebook, and they think they're engaging with someone of a similar age to them. And I can think of this as an actual example that I had to deal with in a former school, and I'm not going to name any names now. But one pupil thought they were speaking to someone around the same age, around 15, who wanted to meet them at King's Cross in London. And I remember they asked me, do you think this is all right? Do you think I should go? And instantly all the alarm bells under the sun, begin to ring. And the reality is we're exposing them more and more and more in kind of an unfettered manner to all the ills and evils of what's on the internet. You've also got the element of bullying. If you're being bullied, and I think we do have kind of two elements of bullying within schools, that happens in school and that happens outside of school. But if you, again, you're allowing pupils unfettered access to a mobile phone in the day and they're haranguing someone and they never speak up about it, the issues that can cause to any child, self-harm, potential suicide at its absolute worst. And sorry to get kind of quite close to the bone there. But there are just so many safeguarding issues in and around mobile phones and mobile phone use. I'd even question, should kids under the age of 16 or 18 even have a mobile phone? How we'd ever enforce that, I don't know. But I think by giving that safe haven of 6 or 7 hours a day of just not being sat in front of a screen is a real positive for children. And I hate to think what damage it might do to their brain development over time as well. It'd be interesting to see studies around that, should studies arise as to what kind of impact that does have. But the safeguarding aspect for me is massive. And I just think that the benefit that phones bring versus the issues they bring, the balance is the wrong way, and they bring far more problems than they do solutions.
Completely. And I'll let Andrew follow up in a second, but in terms of how we've gone about that, and it was very much from a safeguarding point of view. So if people have read, and people obviously have read Keeping Children Safe in Education, because we all have to read that, but in terms of the nuance and the detail, that there's not really a safe way to allow unrestricted access to 4G and 5G in a school building. And that's what the actual sentences are in there. So, those that are allowing mobile phones in school, it'd be interesting to see how what the students are actually accessing through those things. Now, it's very similar to the lineups. It's very similar to some of the warning stuff that you talked about before. People who are against these approaches quite often seem to be placing themselves on the side of the child and saying that this is what they would want. You know, move with the times, technology, they need this, 21st century jobs, etc. You know, this is just anecdotal evidence of what we've seen. We have seen at lunchtime and break time, and that's going to be my next question, Sam, about unstructured time. Yeah. We have seen children playing. Children playing football, basketball, talking to their friends. Now, in society more widely, you don't see that. You just don't see people playing cricket, tennis, football, whatever it might be, you know, talking to their friends and not having the pressure of thinking I am contactable at all times, whether it be by friends, bullies, parents, whatever it might be. You know, you just got the freedom to be a child. And actually, again, these policies that people are saying that we're some way taking away from their experience is actually adding to it. So meandering around to a question again, talk to about your unstructured time. How do you go about managing that, obviously, without mobile phones and all the things that brings?
Yeah, so mobiles aren't an issue. We're fairly stringent in terms of confiscation of mobile phones as a school. But in terms of the kind of the geography of our building, our eatery areas aren't big enough to accommodate the entire school population in one go. We've got nearly 2,000 pupils at the school. So from a secondary phase perspective, where there's about 1,600 pupils, we do have a rotating lunchtime, whereby two-year groups go out at a time, and they go either to our main hall to eat a packed lunch, to our main restaurant to eat a hot plated dinner, or we've got an outdoor kind of eatery, which has got a shack and a canopy, and they'll eat kind of al fresco, as if you're by the Colosseum in Rome, when it's sunny and nice, you know, an outdoor kind of meal deal. And lunch is half an hour, and deliberately half an hour, because which sounds short, but what we found pupils citing was actually just it. We had a longer lunch a couple of years ago. It's too long. Actually, it was boring. There isn't a lot to do. But we do find, even within that half an hour window, very much like yourselves, pupils will go on the school field and play football, which we're very happy that they go and do, play cricket, play basketball in the basketball courts, play tennis in the tennis courts, and table tennis as well. We've got a number of table tennis tables, and they go and play that. And it's brilliant to see kids just being, do you know what, kids. And I wouldn't want to take that away and make it so ordered and so rigid at lunchtime. I would if I thought that it was chaos and kids were causing each other problems and we had, you know, fights galore, but we don't. They are just using that kind of 20 minutes once they've eaten to be kids. And we've got enough staff that police the school, you know, during those window lunch windows to ensure that it's, you know, appropriately supervised. But our kids do just be kids, which is nice to see.
As you said, Sam, about kids being kids, back onto the mobile phones. I think obviously, you know, Phil and I both done the DSL route. You've got the eSafety. This is why we're doing it. But a scene that will stick with me, you know, quite easily was last academic year before we put the mobile phone policy into place, Phil. I saw three lads sat on a bench, and we allowed phones at break and lunchtime. So they sat on a bench, three lads just sat there all on their phones, not engaging, not talking to each other. And they were probably texting each other, do you know what I mean? They were sat next to each other. And you thought, surely, this is not what it's about. And as you said, Sam, just go and be a kid. But you're spot on. You know, you just want kids to be kids. Yeah. And go out, as Phil said, when he's on the fields with his Panama hat on, you know, the green high-vis, so we can't miss him at all. But you look across the field, and it sounds quite a romantic image. You've got the kids out there, as you said, Phil, got some sat there, some playing football, some playing, you know, rounders, whatever, but that's what it's all about. And they're not on their phones, and you give them that opportunity to be what they should be. It's just a kid.
Absolutely.
And I've used your line at home, Sam, as well, with my child who's in year 8. So he's got an Apple Watch, so he nicked it off me. I'll have to get another one. And, you know, he's doing end of year exams. So a couple of times this week, he's texted me to tell me his results. Now, I start thinking, if I let you off, I'll let you down. If I let you off, I'll let you down. Because if I reply to that text and condone his, you know, I'm going to say subversive. It's not subversive. It's covert use of mobile technology. I think then I'm letting him off, aren't I? I'm excusing his behaviour. And I think I spend my entire day not excusing this kind of thing. So I've not replied to any of his texts. And, you know, when I saw him last night, it was very much the case of, you better stop that. But well done on 93%. you know, but it is. That's the hard thing to do, isn't it? Keeping that up all the time. Right. Last couple of questions, Sam, because I'm really grateful for your time. But we're just milking it because it's the last episode. You know, we're trying to go longer than we know. So we're already over an hour, listener. I mean, goodness me. We never, ever do that normally, do we? So let's get back into the classroom and let's talk about how important at your school are the starts and the ends of lessons.
They're massive. There you go. Answered. No, I mean, they're really, really important. Good night. That's it. Thank you. And good night. Drop the mic. No, they're really, really important. And we've got a very set kind of institutional routine to how we start lessons. And it's really deliberate because we want that absolute level of certainty and consistency as you move from one lesson to the next. It allows pupils to know what to expect. So they're not going to mess around without being harsh. And equally, it's become so habitual, teachers almost don't need to think about it, even though they do in terms of what the starter involves. But what we expect is that staff will meet and greet pupils at the door of their classroom with one foot in, one foot out. And, you know, we've worked with staff, we've narrated this about how to do it, but it's the, you know, good morning, Mr. Smith. Good morning, Miss Smith. We're going to have a cracking lesson today. It's great to see you again. You're looking really smart. Last lesson was brilliant. Let's keep it going this lesson. You know, all those kind of positives to get the lesson on a positive, firm footing. There is a retrieval practice starter on the board. And I know there's different opinions and views out there about do now tasks. We don't do it to say, oh, tick, we've done retrieval practice. We do it as a settler. And the retrieval aspect within that is an added bonus. But it is about adding a layer of certainty and conformity to how our lessons begin. And we do expect staff, though, to pick up on misconceptions, to quiz pupils, to engage in verbal Q&A as they give the answers to those retrieval questions. The lesson then moves into kind of the big question for the lesson or series of lessons, and the teacher explains the context of the lesson, and then it's up to the teacher how that lesson then, you know, pans out, because who am I to dictate how science should be taught versus maths versus English versus history versus geography? I mean, ultimately, I'm a history teacher by trade. I can't tell PE how to teach PE, etc. In terms of lesson ends, we've worked hard with staff to think about the exit routines. We want pupils at the tail end of the lesson to pack away in a set manner, to stand behind their chairs, to have all their equipment packed away into their knowledge organizer cases, because we equip all of our pupils with everything that they need. But we want staff to engage in real quality verbal Q&A and choral chanting and rote learning in those final kind of 5, 6, 7 minutes of the lessons to really get the kids to think hard about what they've learned that lesson. Because the temptation with so many lessons is to work to the bell, to work to the last minute, to write, explain. And then you've got no real way of ensuring or capturing that the knowledge is actually there. It's stuck in the pupils' minds. And it's going to be there in their long-term schema if we want to start to get a little bit fanciful with jargon. But then there is a very clear systemized exit routine in terms of one row going at a time. The teacher telling the kids, you know, thank you. Today's been brilliant. We want teachers stood at the door again so they're ready to meet and greet the next class. But they're also saying goodbye to their existing class, saying, great lesson today. That was brilliant. Top stuff. You've got a house point because you did something brilliant. That's the kind of dialogue we want to see. So I just think it's really powerful to have that start and end to lessons. It takes away a level of thinking for staff of how do my lessons begin and end? So they can think more about the meat of the lesson and their subject knowledge and questioning.
Go on, Phil.
No, you go. We can edit all this.
So I back at Easter, Sam, I went to observe one of our history teachers, early teacher, only in his second year. And it's getting about the habitual. So the kids were there because he, no fault of his own. He'd been on break duty. He was making his way up in his pink eye viz. Very fetching, I think, thanks to Mr. Naylor's choice of colours. But when he got there, the kids were there. They were lining up waiting because that's what, you know, they expect to, you said, the meet and greet. Mm. And I like your idea of the end and send, which we had one of our South Shore 7 at the end. And I do worry about sometimes Like, I would keep the either sat down or behind the desk until you hear the bell, because sometimes you see a teacher and they're by the door and the kids are sort of milling around. And in a way, they're a bit like a Max and Paddy. They're like doormen trying to keep them in. But then that's not how you want them to walk out. No. You want them to walk out in an orderly, you know, sensible manner. Whereas not, and all of a sudden you've got the teacher at the door and you've got 30 kids milling around. You're not being able to see what's going on in the back there. So as you said, Sam, keep them behind the desk, either sat down, stood up, until it's ready to go. And as you said, orderly, right, go, 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 go.
And it has an impact on the next lesson. If your lesson ends in a chaotic, mad fashion, the next lesson is going to start for the next member of staff that gets to that class in a mad, chaotic fashion. So it's that consistency across a school can actually help to calm the school down as well. And again, if you're thinking about your SEN children who can't cope with hundreds of people all at once, doing it in a controlled manner actually helps those kind of kids as well.
Definitely. And it's been really, it's ironic in a way, Sam, that we're talking about communicating your expectations and the South Shore Seven and the fact that they're on every staircase. And the deputy head in responsible for behaviour has listed them wrong twice in this podcast, because they are, we do not have meet and greet. We do not have end and send. We have stand and deliver. And the reason I mention it now is because it's exactly what you said there in terms of that was the difference between, and it is essentially, I'm only winding him up, it's essentially end and send, but that's too generic, isn't it? You can do anything there, can't you? You can stand at the door and say, off you go. Oh, well, that's the end of my lesson. I sent them. Stand and deliver was meant to be right. We all stand at the end of the lesson. We make sure that the classroom's tidy. We make sure that it's an organised environment. And then I deliver them out of the classroom, off down the staircase, off to whatever it's going to be. Because at the moment, we're on a three-period day. So it's down, break, down, lunch, down, end of day. So it was that for that reason. But obviously, I need to do some more work if the deputy head responsible for these doesn't know what they are.
So I give him all the ones.
If you got him started, Sam, he'd be on click and collect next, which is the other one.
Instead of collecting his spec, I'm so conscious about my Argus deliveries. I keep saying click and collect. And they look at me thinking, oh, what's going on there? There's just so much going in that head, Sam. I'll just put it down to old age and senility.
Oh, bless you.
It boils down to those habits, isn't it? And absolutely, the kids learning them again and again, because it's going to benefit the kids at the end of the day.
Right, you know, have routines. And you know what? It really came to fruition, and I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, when we had some visitors in from a university, and they took the students down for part of the lesson. But you know what it's like? It always overruns. So it went down. It's right, year 7, come down here, be in the theatre. Oh, it's overrun. Go back to form. Go back to class. Now, 2 out of 3 classes had still got all the equipment out and put away. Because we practiced the Dugnam of putting away the pens game, and we know where they go, the books and everything else. We did it in literally 30 seconds flat. It was right year 7, end of lesson routine, go. And it was like, bang, 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 bang. And again, the critics of, oh, you're a monster. Oh, you're making them all, you know, automatic. Well, they didn't think so when they're out on the yard 5 minutes earlier than everybody else. They thought it was quite a good thing. They were quite happy with that. So I really do like that kind of routine to the end of a lesson as well as the start, which is often overlooked, isn't it? Lots of people do things at the start, but they don't necessarily do things at the end. Right, we're coming to the end. So just for listeners who've just joined us, so we're talking about the behaviour manual with Sam Strickland. We're also going to signpost to his previous 2 books and previous 2 podcasts. So we've got Education Exposed, and then we've got the sequel, Education Exposed 2 as well, which we can signpost in the show notes. And just last question, Sam, where will you be speaking about the book? What events have you got coming up? And thank you for my invite to Research Ed Northampton as well. I'm sure I'll be packing them in as I was at Research Ed Warrington. I actually was. It was quite a surprise. I brought my child, Sam, along with me for this, expecting to get about 4 people. And they were completely full.
I could see you ramming a room, without a doubt, ramming a hall.
He was like, people actually listen to you. You know, he said, I live with you, I don't listen to you. But there you go. Anyway, go on. Where are you going to be speaking, Sam? What are we going to be doing? How are we going to be promoting it?
I mean, the key ones, I guess, are this autumn. I've got my own research ed, Research Ed Northampton, on the 22nd of October. I volunteered to speak at Research Ed Surrey and Research Ed Nottingham. So, you know, from a Saturday event kind of extravaganza, I'll be doing that Holy Trinity this autumn. And then I'm speaking for a couple of trusts over the next couple of weeks and doing kind of outreach work in terms of behaviour, because we're a behaviour hub lead school as well. But I mean, key events would be those three that I've cited.
And you're very generous with your time, aren't you, Sam? Because I often see it on Twitter as well about you invite people in to your school, don't you, to have a look around. So is that still an option for listeners if they're interested to message you and get in touch?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had, nearly 1,000 people visit the school now across the profession, which is really humbling that so many people want to come and have a look at what we do. And hopefully they've come away from those events, those days, gained something from it. But yes, we do invite and allow people to come to the school. We tend to do it as kind of big events as opposed to kind of bespoke, one-to-ones. So we normally have kind of 20 or 30 people at a time. And we do sort of 3 or 4 of those a year now. But if anybody would like to get in touch, I'm more than happy to organise or point them to when our next organised day will be.
Fantastic. Right. So just the bit to finish off with. So thank you to Mr. Perman for his first and last co-hosting appearance.
It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. And thanks to Sam for, 5 outings on Nailers Natter. Thanks for your support over the years. Really appreciate it. And thank you to you, the listener, for listening. Some of you are listening to 170-odd episodes right back from day one when I propped up a phone into an iPad and just went straight live and did it through to, more gimmicks that we've had along the way, film reviews, book reviews, vinyl suite, you know it. But really appreciate you being there. Hopefully we're still going to be around in some form via books and everything else. But yes, goodbye for now. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
So I've decided to end the podcast on a bit of a bombshell, although I have been flagging this up on Twitter for quite some time. After 3.5 years and over 160 episodes, I've decided to hang up the microphone. The process of pulling together, transcribing and collectivising all the discussions from across the years convinced me now that the timing is right to end our natters. We've come full circle. The vision for the podcast at the start was to showcase and highlight the work of the fabulous educational community. A chance to just talk to teachers and establish myself and develop myself and others professionally. Through the careful selection and combination of the work of others with my own reflections in this book, I've been able to present the best that has been thought and said on the podcast and keep it as a living resource. The book in the back catalogue will now hopefully provide a holistic guide, a compendium of some of the best educational thinking of this fascinating time in education and our world. The interactive nature of the interviews, nuggets and podcast links will mean this book can be used for education, reflection, staff room discussion or a book club focus. The 18-month writing process will be definitely worth it if just one school uses this as a template for professional learning discussions. I stood on the shoulders of giants when taking my first tentative steps into podcasting. The legendary Craig Barton literally and metaphorically guided me through how to channel the educational talent of the teaching world. The baton can now be passed on to the many and varied educational voices hosting podcasts, and I can return to being a passive observer and consumer of the audio learning available. I still hope to platform the voices of others and continue to learn from the vast untapped resource of the best profession in the world. So, listener, we are done. 3.5 years and a book, and I say farewell but not goodbye, hopefully. Thank you for everyone's support with the podcast during this time, and I hope that the legacy of the podcast continues to support teachers over the next few years and this resource is used in schools and beyond. Thank you.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.